If I live to be some crazy age, like 106, and people want to interview me, I'm going to be like those old ladies that they ask, you know, how did you live to be 114? Well, I drank a shot of buttermilk every day. Well, if they ask me, I'm going to make up some crazy shit like, every Wednesday I ate an entire pine cone and my own weight in bird seed. So my initial inclination was to get a little soundbite from the famous FDR speech where he talked about the bombing of Pearl Harbor. December 7th, 1941 will go down as a date in infamy. And I was going to use that, but I thought to myself, no, I'm not going to do that. That's going to be too much, like it's like a prop comedian. It'd be like watching a prop comedian. It's like too overproduced. I need to keep the bar low for my fans, you know. I keep it underproduced. I don't need sound bites. I don't need special effects. I don't need, it's just my little dog and pony show, you know. But February 2nd, even though this comes out on the 3rd, will go down as the day in infamy. Why? And I'm going to tell you why. There's a lot of shit happened today. First and foremost, shout out to my producer daughter, Vanessa. She had a birthday. When this airs, it'll be yesterday, but which is the same day as Groundhog Day, so it's Groundhog Day again. As I'm recording, it's Groundhog Day again. And but it's also my producer daughter's birthday. That's pretty cool. And over the years, we've had some good birthdays. We've had some fun. I remember her 21st was a fun one. We had a big banquet out at BJ's Brewery. And then I was talking to her earlier this afternoon about the time that we just split from work. And just, we left Nissan. She used to work at Nissan with me. And we just bolted right after work. Because we're always working on our birthdays. Aren't we always working on our birthdays? Doesn't it seem like, I mean, are you like me? Is it just kind of, it is kind of another day. It's just another day. It's just another day. But it's not. It's your birthday. You know. Come on, shawty. It's your birthday. But, we took off one day. We even ditched her boyfriend. We left him hanging. We left right from the dealership. Took mom. Took our friend Ashley. And we burned rubber. Went up to Black Elk Casino. And it's good times. But, so even though yesterday was her birthday, we're going up to Tahoe. We're going to do some Tahoeing. We're going to do some Tahoeing. Yeah. We're going to head up Sunday morning. Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. Truckosaurus squares off with the grave digger. Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. And we're going to be going up to the mountain as people are leaving the mountain because we go against the flow like salmon. And We're gonna make a day of it. We got some reservations up at the Chart House, which is a fine establishment. My dad used to take me there when I was just a little tadpole. And on subsequent journeys, as he would go there, he would illuminate me with highlights of how the salad bar had just shovel. He would get shovelfuls of like caviar from the salad bar. So and I'm. Thought to myself, I don't know, maybe I even told him, like, Dad, that's, I don't know, it's probably not top shelf quality if it's in the salad bar, but, you know, do you, man, right on. But February 2nd, there's a lot of shit went down on February 2nd. February 2nd is, oddly enough, it is my sister's wedding anniversary. How do I know that? Well, because I'm a good brother and I remember. And also, Well, I'll get to that in a second. But it's also my grandfather's wedding anniversary, which I think maybe my sister was kind of doing a little copycat crime. And so 02/02/22, here we are. And my grandfather, of course, now he passed away, in 2018. So he was an interesting cat. My two favorite stories of my grandfather is when he was shipped out. He joined the Navy when he was, I think he was underage. I think he was 17. He joined up before he could get drafted or something to that effect. And they shipped out and they were going to Okinawa. And there was rumors that he had kind of a Japanese girlfriend out there. But my grandfather's kind of one of those guys, like everywhere he goes, like you'd go around town with my grandfather. Everybody knew him. My grandfather Willard. Everybody knew him. You'd go into like, the diner and everybody know, "Hey, Willard, how you doing? Can I get you a cup of coffee? Same old Willard. Or what are you having today, Willard?" You know, everybody knew Willard, right? You go to the golf course, everybody knew him there. But so he was always, you know, he's just that guy. He just, you know, he's always kind of had some crazy story to tell, some BS about something. So it wouldn't surprise me if he had a little geisha out there. I don't know. But on the way out, to occupy their time in the Navy on the ship, there was some story about having to scrape off the old floor tiles of the ship that he was on. This was some menial task, you know, and they gave all the seamen their hammers to start prying up these floor tiles, and he commenced to immediately. He decided to just throw his hammer over the overboard, like just chucked it right out in the Pacific Ocean, because he'd be damned if he was going to start scraping floor tile up. And so his CO or somebody came by and said, "Hey, what happened to your hammer? Where's your hammer, Seaman Brophy?" He's like, "I don't know. Some son of a bitch stole it." And then when he got out of the Navy, and I want to say it was Treasure Island where they pulled in, and the ship of all these Navy seamen just getting back from overseas, you know, pulling into Treasure Island there, right in the San Francisco Bay, and they just took all their bags, all their duffel bags, and threw them into one giant pile, one giant mountain pile. I mean, you're talking, what, 300, 400, 500, 600, I don't know, just a mountain of these duffel bags, these military-issued duffel bags. And so what does he do? Well, this is my grandfather for you. He goes, he said, "To hell with this shit." And he goes down to the local watering hole and knocks back a beer. And, because there's about 600 Navy seamen just sorting through these bags trying to find their shit, he just decided to go down and wet his whistle. And by the time he got back, there was one bag left, and it said Brophy on it. So shout out to Willard Brophy, the man, the myth, the legend. And played semi-pro baseball for the Giants, worked for PG&E for 40 years, retired, and played golf until he couldn't play golf anymore. But yeah, so February 2nd, day that will go down in infamy. Daughter's birthday, grandfather's wedding anniversary. And getting back to my sister now, the reason I know, among other reasons, reason I know that it's February 2nd is because of the simple reason that she got married in Arcadia, which is down, it's right next to Pasadena. My brother-in-law, the raging Armenian that he is that's Arcadia, Pasadena, that area is kind of an enclave for the Armenian contingent in Southern California. And so her wedding was on Saturday the 2nd. The next day was February 3rd, Super Bowl Sunday. And why is that significant? Because 20 years ago, February 3rd, I was driving back from Pasadena listening to Tom Brady win his first Super Bowl 20 years ago. 02, 02, 02. Well, his is 03, but... And so that's where it all began, you know? And, you know, not to make some schmaltzy big thing about it, because there's, you know, I'm sure, you know, I saw plenty of, like, Instagram little tributes and then parody type of parody Instagram messages about what most NFL fans and older white guys are probably doing, talking about the first time that they ever watched him or whatever. But and that can that's neither here nor there. Like, I'm not that guy. I'm just gonna, but I will break it down like this. Okay. That first Super Bowl, okay, so by the end of his career, so after 20 years, this guy, these stats, he appeared in how many? 20 in 20 seasons, he reached the playoffs 19 times. There was only one year. That was the year after he won his first Super Bowl, when they beat the Rams, and they were huge underdogs. But I had this weird feeling he was going to win. But the next year, they went 9-7, and it was a three-way tie for first. But the tiebreaker went to the Jets, so it was Chad. What was his name? The quarterback. Chad Pennington took, I think, yeah, that was the year that Pennington took him. Did they go? They didn't go to the AFC Championships. But anyway, they ended up winning the division, even though they had the same record, because of the tiebreaker. And that was the only year Tom Brady hadn't been to the playoffs. So overall, in 20 seasons... He went 10-4 in conference championships. That's ridiculous. That alone's ridiculous. Okay? So in 20, let's see, is it 20? How would you count that? 21? Is it 21 full season? 22 season. Well, if you count like the first year he rode the bench behind Drew Bledsoe, because that's really what I was a Drew Bledsoe fan. I was a huge Drew Bledsoe fan. And then when he got knocked out, they were 1-4. The Patriots were 1-4 when he got knocked out and sidelined for most of the regular season. And that's when Brady came in, and he went 10-1 to take him to the playoffs and then win the Super Bowl. But in 20 seasons, to reach the playoffs 19 times, and he got 18 division titles? Fucking hell. And he was counting Tampa Bay, he was 10-4 in conference championships. I mean, that's just ridiculous. That's virtually two-thirds of the time he was in the conference championships. So 2 out of 3 years, he was playing in the conference championships. 2 out of 3 times, he was one game away from the Super Bowl. And then he had, let's see, he ended up going 6-3 with the Patriots in Super Bowls. So he appeared in 9 Super Bowls with the Patriots and 10 overall out of 22 seasons. It's almost 50% of the time. Almost half the time, if you don't count the first season he rode the bench. Every other season, he's in the Super Bowl. That's ridiculous. And then 2 out of 3 times he's in the conference championships. Just ridiculous. I mean, that alone just is staggering to break down those numbers. So 7 wins in 10 appearances. Like, his winning percentage in the Super Bowl is 700%. I mean, it just, my God. So he won 9 AFC championships. He won 10 overall. He lost 4. They were always in it. Even the ones he lost, like against 2 against the New York Giants, the 2 against the Giants, they were always in that game. Always, always in that game. Until the last minute. Because it was always like a 4-point difference that they lost in each of those games, if I'm not mistaken. And then the one they lost against the Eagles, he was driving, but what'd they do? They knocked the ball loose, recovered a fumble. But they were still in that game. I mean, they were driving. It was an 8-point, I think it was an 8-point gap. But, I mean, this is the guy that, I mean, they're always in it. The only time that they, like, even in the Super Bowls that they won, the six that they won with, that he won with the Patriots, it was always just the difference of, say, like, a field goal. I mean, he beat the Rams with a field goal. He beat the Carolina Panthers with a field goal. He beat the Eagles. That wasn't a game-winning field goal, but it always came down to the wire when they beat the Seahawks. I mean, it was the last. That was the interception to Malcolm Butler that Russell Wilson threw. I mean, the Seahawks should have won that game. But every game, it was the only time that it was an outright. So the only time that that he ever had like an outright just dominating win was last year with the Bucks. They beat the Chiefs 33-9. That was the biggest gap that he'd ever had in any win. Like, it was always just scratching out a win. So it wasn't like he overpowered anybody, you know? He just knew how to claw his way to a win. So that's pretty, and most of the regular season was like that too. You know, this is a guy that's, if you look at it, the stats, as far as win-losses go, he only had one season where he had a single-digit win. That was the 9-7 season, his second full year after he won the first Super Bowl. That's fucking insane. Like, it was all, you know, aside from that, I mean, the lowest total he ever had was a 10-6 year. But after, you know, it seemed like every year was like 12-4, 13-3, 14-2, 14-2, 16-0. I mean, how many times did he win 21? He won 21 in a row twice that spanned between seasons. You know, he'd go on like a 9-game win streak to end the season and then begin the next season with a, you know, 12, you know, go 12 straight right out of the gate. Fucking just, dude knows how to, but he'd play with a chip on his shoulder, you know? I mean, that's what it came down to. The most storybook season, I would have to say, was the year he won Super Bowl 51 against the Falcons. And that went to overtime. But that was brilliant. That was great because basically, like, he spent the first 4 games of that season and suspended because of that stupid-ass Deflategate that they threw out of court because it was stupid. They just tossed it out. The judge overturned it, and Roger Goodell, that fucking turd, he had Brady sit out 4 games, you know? Do they have anybody else, you know? I mean, the other guys that are, like, abusing their girlfriends and stuff like that, the Ray Rices of the NFL and so forth that, you know, get caught, you know, smacking their girl around on camera, did he ever serve a suspension? I don't even know. But they made a... They made an example out of our boy, and what's he do? He comes back, runs the table, goes to the playoffs, and I remember that day was insane. Like I was working that day, of course, Super Bowl Sunday. I was over at VW, and matter of fact, at halftime, I was watching highlights because it was dead as disco over at VW as usual. That place was just funeral parlor disguised as a dealership. But I turned at halftime, we went most of it. I think I went home right at halftime where they were down like 21 nothing, something like that, 21-3 at the half. I mean, they were just getting their shit pushed in, you know, and it was ugly. And even into the third quarter with 5 minutes to go, it's 28-3. And then he comes and then he's just rallied these guys. He's just shouting at them, you know, on the sideline. It's not over. It's not over. At 28-3, man, with 5 minutes left in the third, most guys think it's over. Not this motherfucker. Came back. Back-to-back. Like one of the greatest catches I've ever seen by Julian Edelman, by anybody. To keep him alive. And then Dante Hightower causes knocks the ball loose from the Falcons quarterback, drawing a blank, Matt something. Fuck. Anyway, got him back in the game. They put up back-to-back scores and then converted on 2 two-point conversions to go to overtime. And then just drove the field. And then James White finishes it off. Fucking storybook. Greatest comeback ever in any game, in any situation ever. Because he's playing with a chip on his shoulder, right? I mean, they did everything they could. Like, they did everything they could to bury this guy with this fake-ass deflate gate, you know? And all that shit. And, you know, the haters want to hate. I get it. You know, Roger Goodell wants to hate, you know, ESPN, all those talking heads over at ESPN. They want to hate. And he, it's just like it fuels him, you know? It's like, you know, it's a lot like, there's just things, you know, there's certain guys that are just made differently, you know? They sustain themselves. They nourish themselves. That's the word I was looking for. They nourish themselves on doubters and haters and stuff. You know, Albert Einstein said it best. I think he said, great thinkers great thinkers always get great thinkers always get, damn it. Great thinkers always get, great thinkers always get, fuck! Well, anyway. Great minds have always received violent opposition from mediocre thinkers. That's what it is. I had to look that shit up. Sorry. But that's what it is. To boil it down to its essence, it's these haters that just see this success. And sure, it's probably like annoying, the amount of success, but why are you there? Why else are you there? Who wants it most? Who wants it the most, you know? But, you know, there's never been a better example than, say, just recently, these fucking these fucking mental midgets in the administration that had this big EV electric vehicle conference, some big EV forum or get together, the heads of, you know, the GM, Ford, like the Biden administration, whoever's in charge of, I don't know if it's, it's obviously not Biden specifically. That guy doesn't even know where he's at, unfortunately. And, but who knows? Is it Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, or whoever's in charge of putting together the forum for these great EV opportunities, conveniently left out our boy Elon, who should have been the keynote speaker. This guy, talk about people wanting to take somebody down. People are trying to, I don't know why, you know, this is the one billionaire who actually hasn't even been in space yet, as opposed to fucking Dr. Evil and Richard Branson. But Elon's just the guy that's putting his own money to task to try and save humanity. And he's the one that's developed all the, you know, you get, when Nissan came out with their all electric Leaf, it was, I got one and it was fun. It was a novelty, but he had already created the technology. He'd already almost perfected the technology, and then he made it look good. And now, that was 2008. So the Obama administration gave him the subsidies and the government loan, which he paid back in full and paid back with interest. The government actually made money on the loan in the Obama administration with this fucking waterhead Biden and as vice president. And now, 14 years later, when they have this EV summit with all the heads of GM and Ford and whoever, and they don't invite the one guy that is knows it inside and out. I mean, that's just hate, man. But that's what I say. Like, you know, these mediocre minds that are creating all this opposition just out of spite. It's probably out of spite because he's very vocal on how backwards ass they are over there. It's sad. It's, you know, it can be documented in so many different ways. You know, there's just so much, there's just hate. And, to be conspicuously absent from something that he knows inside and out is, to me, it seems like a slight. That is definitely a slight. And mother, you know, but there's quite a few examples of that, you know, but you look at the myopic vision of, well, I mean, the last couple administrations, let's face it. I mean, talking to these guys, to be some kind of politician now, to be some kind of sycophantic politician in these administrations, you've got to be, it's like, it'd be like a sea of middle managers. It'd be like a sea of like real estate agents or something, you know. Who would want to even talk to these people, you know? They don't, you can just tell how just fake, how just fucking fake and just transparent they are. You know, there's such a huge, huge lack of self-awareness with these people that it's just, it's almost gross. But, you know, there's so many examples to be made of just the indignation that these people have for the innovator, you know, for the people that are really kind of, that don't have time for this nonsense, you know. It's Yeah, it's really sad. It's really sad. But, you know, ultimately things just, you know, the right situation rises to the top, you know? Take, for example, like this whole debacle with, Joe Rogan and these people that are kind of jumping on the bandwagon. And this is just a guy that just wants to, he wants everybody to kind of get along. You know, he wants, if anything, to have a talk about what it is like, instead of a one-sided debate or a one-sided take or a one-sided perspective on all of this stuff. You know, he's the type that would, obviously the people that are the haters are the ones that obviously don't listen to him. And that's a classic example, because they don't understand, like, you know, this is about presenting information. This is about looking at, you know, instead of just kind of going along with everything, going along with the narrative, you know, why not get the whole the whole spectrum of information on this, right? Because I don't think he's promoting anything anti-vaccination. The whole thing now is like, if it, you know, if you bring up anything that hints at vaccine hesitancy, you're just shut down. You know, you're canceled or you're deplatformed, and you're censored. And that is not, well, that's not what this country is about, as far as I know. Matter of fact, one of the things that he says that, you know, he's said more than once is, the one way to combat bad speech is to have better speech. So open things up for debate, right? And he's had guests on there that are very controversial. But, you know, he wants to hear it himself. And if oppositional views voice their opposition, he's invited them to come on and debate the whole subject. And that's the way it should be. There should be an open line of communication. Communication is the key, you know? But all the accusers are the ones that, if anybody is spewing misinformation, it's the people that are accusing him, you know? These pulpits like CNN, they've had much of their latest bullet points fall apart, like the Steele dossier, for example, that proved to be erroneous and made up and actually tracked back to Hillary, of all people. You know, and they're the ones kind of backing the whole narrative of misinformation. I mean, hello, pot. Meat kettle, you know, they seem to be more divisive than anything I've heard from Rogan ever. You know, what this is like a power grab, okay? Because their narrative is falling apart, okay? So obviously now you don't have to quarantine as long as originally intended. The mask debate is really, it's a joke. Now we've got 1.6 billion of these masks in the ocean, and this poor guy who's running the country, who I think he died 3 months ago, he just doesn't know it. It's his administration that you can't even, who's in charge over there? I was watching Aziz Ansari the other night. That was It was one of his first specials back. I guess he got canceled for something a while back. They're all, you know, these poor comedians, you know, they're just trying to be funny, you know, and they all get shot down. They all get canceled. I mean, the one that really kind of deserved it was Bill Cosby, but they acquitted him. I mean, what the fuck? But so he has this special out on Netflix. It's called Nightclub Comedian. It was pretty damn funny too, because he's basically talking about like, who's in charge of the administration? What's going on? Like, the minute that Kamala Harris knew she won, we never saw her again. Where is this woman? They're keeping her under wraps because nobody likes this bitch. You know? Like, and they're obviously painfully aware of this, because they're hiding her like they're hiding body of Jesus Christ in the basement of the Vatican. You'll never get to see her. You know what I mean? It's tragic. But anyway, the special was pretty good. It was pretty funny, but he made a good point. And one, he kind of talked about the homeless situation, kind of people that need help. And I was even talking to a cohort of mine just earlier today about the fact that rents are rising, they're constantly rising, home prices are rising, price of goods are rising, gas prices are rising, constantly rising, you know, food prices are rising, just to go out and eat, just to go through a drive-through, everything's rising, right? One thing that's stagnating are wages. You know, so he made a point. He's like, he said, you know, people just decided that their jobs, it wasn't worth it, you know, to be going through this crap job that you don't like. And so they would simply tell their boss, I don't want to be here. I'm leaving. And there's all these, you know, people leaving their jobs. And the employers are like, okay, bye. And then they get, you know, they go from, and I see it. In the blood centers that I pick up from, all these nurses that are just jumping ship, and their employers are just letting them go. Goodbye. So what are we left with? And he goes on to say, what are we left with? Well, we're left with kind of this ragtag, kind of a crappier version of what you used to have. And isn't that the case when you go out to eat, or if you go somewhere, you go to a hospital, you go to a restaurant, you go to anywhere, go to KFC where my son is, they're understaffed, everybody's understaffed. So the experience is that much shittier, you know? And the debate, of course, prior to, you know, all of this back in the previous administration was, the debate for minimum wage rising, you know, the minimum wage. How can we get the minimum wage? Well, we can't raise the minimum wage. You go to McDonald's and you'll pay $12 for a burger. Well, that's a bunch of horseshit too, because they certainly vote the CEOs of those companies pay raises quite often, don't they? But the frontline wage earners, they don't see a dime of that. Nothing changes for them. But, so these people all were leaving. They're like, okay, I'm out of here. Fuck this place. And their employer's like, okay, bye. And so now we're left with a crappier version. They're going to hold their own. But the thing that tied it all together was, all of a sudden, when we're all stuck at home in these ridiculous lockdown situations that don't work, that are counterproductive, all of a sudden, all these stimulus checks start coming. Oh, we got money for you. We don't have money for the homeless, but we got money for you. Here's $1,200. And you get one $1,200 check, right? And then you get a follow-up, whatever it was. I don't even remember what it was. So the minute you're stuck in your house and you have nowhere to go, and you're losing your mind, your mental health is already on the brink, and now you're stuck just staring at the wall all day, Well, we got money for you now. We got money for you now. We got money. I mean, it's such a hypocrisy. And so who's running the ship here? Again, see, so all these kids, now all these school-age kids who are wearing these masks in class, the healthiest demographic in the nation, sitting in class with these masks, are now at a disadvantage, and they have arrested development because you can't, as you watch somebody speak, and if you communicate with people, you're looking at their expressions, and you're looking at the way their mouth moves, and you're looking at their, you're learning how to socialize, you're learning how to volley, and you're learning how to articulate. Well, now they've all got masks on. They don't see shit. They can't, you know, now they're losing ground on development. I mean, these guys can't run a fever. These idiots in office can't run a fever. And now they're all backpedaling on the amount of days you get to quarantine because it just goes to show you that, you know, the whole thing was just kind of a, they were just kind of making shit up in the early onset. And that's all that Rogan was talking about. He's talking about that dipshit Fauci. It's like, one day masks are good, next day they're not. And why aren't masks good? Because the real reason was because all of the masks in the world were in China, and we can't get shit from China. So because there's a shortage, they panicked and said that you don't need, nah, masks don't work. And now masks work. Now you need a double mask. What's the real story? Is that what you call misinformation? That's what I would call misinformation, but yet the only one that's really misinforming everyone is Joe Rogan, you know, a stand-up comedian and UFC announcer. Go fuck yourselves. He's the bastion of misinformation. Oh my God. Well, the truth is, Spotify needs Rogan more than he needs them, honestly. Now, that's a million. It's 11 million. That's 11 million customers every time he broadcasts. CNN can't. They don't boast that. Fox doesn't have those numbers. MSNBC doesn't have those numbers. So, I don't know what to tell you. It's just this, I mean, how do people in the administration and these administrations live with themselves? You know? It's so gross. I get it now. When I read about certain people or I listen to certain, you know, there's certain people that I admire for different reasons. One of them, I was listening to an interview with Todd Rundgren, and he was talking to Rick Rubin, the great producer who worked with Johnny Cash and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and you name it, Metallica. He was interviewing Todd Rundgren. Todd Rundgren was a big, huge name back in the 70s. He's basically got, his first big hit was, "Hello, it's me. I thought about us for a long, long time. Maybe I think too much and something's wrong. There's something here that doesn't last too long. Seeing you or seeing anything as much as I do you, I come around to see you once in a while, or if I ever need a reason to smile and spend the night if you think I should." Well, anyway, And then he had his other one that was kind of a romp. It was kind of like a funny little throwaway song. Kind of reminds me of like that book, Trout Fishing in America. Just kind of a weird, off the cuff kind of thing that didn't make a whole lot of sense. But his other big hit was, I don't want to work, I just want to bang on the drum all day. I don't want to play, I just want to bang on the drum all day. That was a huge hit, but they're just two goofy little throwaway, you know, they're good songs, but this guy, basically he really made his name as a producer. He produced albums for like Badfinger, you know, that was a great band back in the day. Let's see. They had that one song. I remember finding out about you. Every day my mind is all around you. Do, 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 do. Looking out from my lonely gloom. Day after day. Bring it home, baby, make it soon. I'll give my love to you. But he also did, albums for, The Band, which was like, you know, Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm, you know, up on Cripple Creek, she sends me. They're the band. They call themselves The Band because they're the backup band for Bob Dylan, but they became huge. But he did their album. He did XTC. And then, but the biggest one was Meatloaf's album, Bat Outta Hell, one of the highest selling albums of all time. So anyway, he's a great producer, but he sees through all the bullshit, right? So when he was elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he didn't even go. He went to play like a small like club gig the same night that he was being inducted. So I think it was Patti Smith who gave the induction speech, which is perfect because she's like punk, you know, anti-establishment. But as she's giving the speech, he's down at some club playing playing a little gig. That's classic. But I get that because all the pomp and circumstance of all, you know, stuff like that, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or, you know, these electric vehicle summits and all this fucking bullshit that just blown smoke up your ass. It's just all fake and everyone's glad handing everybody and being fake and being all slimy and creepy. I get it when people don't want to be part of that. I loved it when Bob Dylan, when he won the Nobel Prize in Literature, didn't even show up. Fucking great. That's punk. That's fucking punk. I get it now, you know? I get it. I was watching an interview with Cormac McCarthy. Probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, living writer of our time. He wrote No Country for Old Men, which they made the movie, the Coen brothers made the movie out of. He wrote The Road. They made a movie out of that with Viggo Mortensen. He wrote All the Pretty Horses, that won the National Book Award. He wrote Blood Meridian, which is just a nutso. That's a crazy, violent, dark, dark, dark book. But he's an interesting cat, too, because he just downplays every, like, from... Because his first book came out, I think, was it Sutri? I think it might have been his first book, or the Orchard Tree. Anyway, he'd been writing books since 67. His first book, I think, was written like in 67. So from 67 to 92, he did no interviews. He did no readings. He wouldn't go to a bookstore and read. You know, I remember when I was working at Tower Books, I was off that day, but Anne Rice, they did it. She came in for a book signing. And she came in and she played it up. She was wearing like a vampire cape and all this stuff. And she had her entourage. And it was a big deal. But Cormac McCarthy, not a chance. This guy wanted no part of that. No readings. no interviews. It's just like, and he, and this was, now, this is a guy's married, living out of hotels. He was so broke. He worked as like a mechanic for quite a while just to pay his bills, but living out of hotels, his wife would just beg him to at least do a book reading, you know, make some money, some supplementary money. And there's something so genuine and authentic about that. But it was a time where he needed the money, but he wouldn't do it. He would just open up another can of beans and that was dinner that night, you know? But now he's a member of the Santa Fe Institute, which is like some place in New Mexico, like where all these geniuses hang out. He's like the only writer there. Like everyone else is like biophysicists and neuroscientists and these, you know, great thinkers and philosophers. And he's just some dude that's a writer. He's just writing, he writes books mostly about West Texas and all the weirdos that hang out on the plains of West Texas and all the, you know, over the centuries and the Indians and just these odd characters and these violent situations and people that just kind of came up over the plains. I think Oprah was the first one that got him to do an interview. He finally did, but he's a legend now. But I admire like that stoicism, that just kind of like, you know, I'm just going to do this and whatever comes of it is what's going to happen. And that's kind of where Rogan started out. You know, he started out, you know, smoking gravity bongs and then doing fucking podcasts. And he didn't even know what he was saying and didn't promote it. Didn't talk much about, it was just him and Brian Redband just talking shit, you know? And that's genuine. That's authenticity. That is authenticity. That's what I'm talking about. But all this kind of like fake ass, pretentious, this is my narrative, this is my ideology. Fuck ideologies. You know, ideologies are only as good as if you're cornered by your own ideologies. You got to get out of this thinking rut, you know? You got to get out of the rut. Don't be held accountable to an ideology because it just confines your thinking. Just do your thing. I don't know. That's my take on all that. I think these guys have their heads up their asses. And these guys like Neil Young and... like, come on, man. Like, actually listen to an episode. You know? To promote people to come together and talk is what really should be happening. But everyone's got their heads so far up their own asses that... you know? It's just horrible. It's just so nearsighted. It's so short-sighted. That's actually more appropriate. It's short-sighted. They just want to... I don't know. It's gross. It's just gross right now. Everyone is so willing to ride their ideas to the bottom of the ocean. They're so willing to die on that hill so that they aren't wrong. So they can't be labeled as wrong or have to walk anything back and take on some kind of personal accountability or some sort of minor shame, you know, that, you know, this is how it's supposed to be, but when it's been substantially proven otherwise, they're gonna ride that ship right down, all the way down, aren't they? Instead of just being humble, humbling yourself. There's no humility anymore. We don't, as a society, we're not, yeah, anyway. It's a huge lack of humility that we have anymore. But nevertheless, you just got to keep going. Just keep your head down. And just do what you're going to do, right? Just do your thing. And do it humbly. But, I don't know. I wish I had a funnier take on all this, but I don't. And, so I think we're just kind of being, I don't know. As usual, we're being shat upon by those in charge, and it's not going to change. Not anytime soon. So go out and remain true to yourself. Remain true to what it is that you feel is necessary. But be open to criticism. Be open to, you know, I'm not married to any of my ideas, you know? And I used to hate Trump. I thought he was ridiculous. Now I look at him like, good. Well, I mean, I know too much about the guy, unfortunately. I know too much about his business dealings, and he's kind of ruthless and gross, but I don't hate, but looking back, you know, what's the point in hating, you know? It's just a waste of toxicity. It's just pointless toxicity that, and I'm rambling on. I'm done. I'm pulling the plug on this one right now. I'm done. I'll talk at y'all later. All right. Arrivederci, babies.